KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump says his tariffs of foreign cars will bring back American manufacturing. We speak with a Texas mayor in a town with a GM plant. Will tariffs make things better for those workers? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Democratic voters are taking out some of their anger on Democrats in Congress. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez. They say they're not fighting hard enough against the Trump administration, and some are challenging incumbents. Also studying a constitutional sleeping giant, the 14th Amendment, and Branford Marcellus has a new take on a jazz classic. It's Friday, March 28th. Today in 1964, a pirate radio station launched on a literal boat. Radio Caroline gave UK listeners their pop music fix when the BBC wouldn't. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump has signed an executive order ending collective bargaining for wide swaths of federal employees. The White House says the president has the authority to do this. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports unions say they will fight the move.
The White House says under a 1978 federal law, the president can end collective bargaining in federal agencies whose missions involve national security. Already, for example, CIA agents do not have union representation. But now Trump has expanded this to groups of employees at close to 20 other agencies, including the Departments of Agriculture, Veterans Affairs, Health and Human Services, State, Justice, and many others. In a fact sheet, the White House said certain federal unions have declared war on President Trump's agenda. Unions have sued the Trump administration to block some of its actions, including the mass firings of employees and access to sensitive data. They're calling this latest move a retaliatory attack. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The military chief of Myanmar says 144 people have been killed and more than 700 injured in a strong earthquake today. Michael Sullivan reports the quake also shook Thailand, and Thai government officials say at least three people there have been killed.
The U.S. Geological Survey says the 7.7 magnitude quake struck around 12:50 p.m. local time, about 10 miles northwest of the town of Sagang. A magnitude 6.4 aftershock followed about 12 minutes later. Social media shows people cowering on the tarmac at what appears to be the airport in nearby Mandalay, with fallen debris in several parts of the airport's terminal. Additional social media posts from Mandalay show collapsed buildings and debris in the streets. NPR's not confirmed the accuracy of the posts. The quake could be felt here in Chiang Rai, northern Thailand, and as far away as the capital, Bangkok, nearly 500 miles to the south, where there people ran from buildings into the street. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is traveling in the Philippines. He is seeking to strengthen the U.S.'s commitment to the Indo-Pacific region. Hegseth is continuing to reply to questions about sharing information in a text chat about U.S. military strikes on Yemen. From member station KPRG, Nina Rao has more.
When asked whether he took some accountability for the Signal group chat leak on Monday, Hegseth underscored his responsibility for the Defense Department to be prepared and ready to deter and defeat enemies.
As the leader of that department, my job is to advise and work alongside the president and then work with my fellow cabinet members to ensure that we're operationalizing in every way possible, reestablishing that deterrence.
Hegseth will also meet with U.S. troops stationed in the Philippines before heading to his last stop in Japan. For NPR News, I'm Nina Rao. In Manila.
You're listening to NPR. President Trump is appealing a federal court's deportation ruling. It temporarily blocks him from using a wartime power act to deport people who are illegally in the U.S. A lower court judge issued the ruling initially. A federal appeals panel kept that block in place. Trump is now asking the U.S. High Court to overrule them. This weekend marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan. And in Altadena, California, Muslim families are finding ways to bring their children a sense of normalcy after January's deadly fires destroyed their mosque. From member station KCRW, Megan Jamerson reports.
Masjid al-Taqwa is where Rania Copeland and her three kids would normally celebrate Ramadan. Since the mosque burned down, they are gathering at a local school. Copeland says that's helping her kids cope with the trauma of the fires and teaching them an important lesson about spirituality.
They're seeing that it's not just about the kind of physical location, but it really is about the community. It's kind of about your spirit and your heart, and that can go anywhere with you.
After Masjid al-Taqwa's Eid al-Fitr celebration Sunday, the community will start searching for a new permanent home for their mosque. For NPR News, I'm Megan Jamerson in Altadena, California.
Wildfires continue to burn in the Carolinas. Officials in North Carolina say the Black Cove wildfire burning in the western part of that state has now been designated as the highest priority wildfire now burning in the U.S. The weather there is very dry and winds are strong. There are also enormous numbers of dead trees that were blown down during Hurricane Helene. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll hear about how a new executive order from the president could affect the Smithsonian. But first, we want to talk about President Trump's plan to impose a 25% tariff on imported cars and car parts next week. Unionized auto workers are cheering, but investors who own stock in automakers are less enthusiastic. And people who want to buy a new car might have to pay thousands of dollars more. NPR's Scott Horsley has been watching reaction to the president's tariff announcement this week, and he's with us now. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Michelle.
So President Trump says adding a tax on imported cars and car parts will encourage automakers to build more vehicles here in the United States. Is that likely?
You know, it's possible. That's why members of the UAW are excited about this proposal, even though the union did not support President Trump in last year's election. UAW President Sean Fain notes there is extra capacity at U.S. auto plants if automakers wanted to move jobs out of Mexico or other countries and get around this 25% tariff. But it's not a slam dunk that's going to happen. You know, it took decades to build the North American auto supply network. And Carl Brower, who's an analyst at the shopping site IC Cars, says automakers aren't going to unwind that overnight.
This is an industry that doesn't operate on a weekly or monthly or even yearly time frame. It operates on a half a decade or more time frame.
Of the big three Detroit automakers, General Motors is the most dependent on imported vehicles. GM CEO Mary Barr said a couple months ago her company was not going to spend a lot of money to relocate jobs unless she got some clarity about what the tariff landscape was going to look like. And given the roller coaster we've seen with the president's trade policy over the last few weeks, I'm not sure how big a bet anyone's going to want to place just yet.
And I think I saw that GM stock took a beating yesterday. Am I right about that?
Yeah, all the automaker shares suffered, but GM's took the biggest hit, down more than 7%. Nearly half the cars sold in the U.S. are imported, and the half that are assembled here typically contain some imported parts. So most automakers have at least some exposure to these tariffs. Tesla, the electric car maker led by Elon Musk, relies primarily on American-made parts. Its shares actually went up a little bit on the tariff news.
So President Trump has also said that these tariffs will raise a lot of money for the government. How realistic is that?
The White House estimates these auto tariffs would generate about $100 billion a year for the government, and Republicans are counting on that to help offset the cost of the president's tax cuts. But here's the thing. The U.S. only gets that tariff revenue if automakers continue producing cars and parts in foreign countries. If production actually did shift back to the U.S., there'd be no tariff. Tariffs can either bring jobs home or they can raise revenue, but the more they do of the one, the less they can do of the other.
Okay, let's talk about consumers now. For people who are in the market for a new car right now, what should they expect?
They should probably expect to pay more, unless they get out this weekend and make a deal before these tariffs take effect. Most cars sold in the U.S. are going to face some tariff expense, and Brower says that's going to mean higher prices.
There's really no way the cost of producing any vehicle sold in the U.S. doesn't go up from this. The only variable is how much of that gets passed on to the consumer.
Tariffs are likely to add thousands of dollars to the cost of a typical new car. For some people, that'll be a deal breaker. They might buy a used car, so used car prices could also go up. None of this is helpful when it comes to curbing inflation, which the president likes to say is a big reason he got elected.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
President Trump says auto tariffs will bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. Our next guest has some doubts. Jim Ross is the mayor of Arlington, Texas, which is home to a large General Motors auto assembly plant. Mayor Ross, what is your perspective on the president's tariff plan?
Well, we have the General Motors assembly plant here in Arlington that manufactures all of the SUVs made by General Motors. So it's an Escalade, Tahoe, Suburban, whatever. It's made here in Arlington. That plant employs about 5,600 employees. And we're concerned about the livelihood of those employees. If the tariffs go into effect, if consumers are paying more money, are they going to be buying less vehicles now? And if they are, how is that going to affect the employees at the assembly plant? So we've written a letter to the two senators here in Texas, Senator Cornyn and Senator Cruz, to ask them to help intervene on behalf of the automotive industry here in Texas. We have yet to hear a response from them, but hopefully we're going to get through this crisis and come out better at the other end.
Yeah, that was what earlier this month you sent that letter along with the mayor of San Antonio. I'm wondering if maybe, because I read that you said that you don't know how tariffs will benefit any Texans. I'm wondering if maybe you've also reached out to the Trump administration to try and explain how this will benefit people in Texas.
Well, we haven't reached out to the Trump administration directly. I'm a part of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and the mayors of the U.S. Conference has certainly reached out to the Trump administration. We've yet to get a meeting with the Trump administration on this. I know that the U.S. Conference of Mayors, along with mayors in Canada and mayors in Mexico, are meeting next month to discuss tariffs and see what we can do as collective mayors in all three countries to work together like we have done for decades and decades.
You've called this a job-killing threat. What do you envision as the worst-case scenario come April 2nd?
You know, April 2nd, worst-case scenario, the bottom line is consumers are going to be paying for tariffs. And if consumers are paying for tariffs and they can no longer afford vehicles, that means a decrease in the amount of production at our assembly plant, and that is where we're concerned about it being a job-killing threat. If this does ultimately create more jobs, those jobs aren't going to happen overnight. We've spent decades building these plants and getting these things going. General Motors have been here for 60, 70 years. It's going to take a long time for us to see any benefit from this whatsoever. In the meantime, people are going to be paying the price. Mexico's not paying the price. Canada's not paying the price. It is the people here in the United States paying the price.
You mentioned the over 5,000 workers at the General Motors plant. Are you worried that people will move, will leave Arlington, and maybe also affect some of the other businesses that are around the plant, like, say, a diner or a clothing store or something like that?
Listen, we have a lot of businesses that rely upon our General Motors employees. But we also have the vendor type businesses that supply all kinds of parts and materials to the assembly plant. When a vehicle is manufactured, we're not just talking about manufacturing a vehicle from outside the country and bringing it in. We have different components within that vehicle that are manufactured all over the world and brought into the United States. Some are then shipped back and other assembly is done and then brought back. You're talking potentially being able to tariff parts of a vehicle two or three times. That's going to be a tremendous expense that the end consumer is going to be using.
Mayor, I know that mayoral elections in Arlington are nonpartisan, but Arlington is in the 25th congressional district, one that overwhelmingly voted for President Trump. Do residents in Arlington in this district share your concerns about tariffs?
Yeah, they do. You know, I'm very proud of our community. We lie right in the middle of Dallas and Fort Worth. I'd say we're a purple community. We don't consider ourselves blue or red. We just want our streets fixed, our community safe, our citizens to stay employed. And that's what citizens here in Arlington are concerned about. I don't take a position when it comes to national politics, pro or con, one side or the other. I believe that politicians have a duty to do what's best for the community, whether it's a local community like Arlington, the state of Texas, or the federal government.
Mayor, this show is heard in D.C., where there are plenty of Congress people there. You have about 30 seconds to speak to them to try and get some security for your city and for the jobs there.
You know, if I could speak to them directly, I would say, y'all, stop attacking the other side, one way or the other. I don't care about that, or the community doesn't care about that, and start doing what's best for the communities as a whole. We don't want to hear blame placed on everybody else. We want people to do their job.
That's Mayor Jim Ross of Arlington, Texas. Mayor, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. Y'all have a great day.
President Trump signed an executive order yesterday directing Vice President J.D. Vance to eliminate, quote, divisive race-centered ideology, unquote, from the Smithsonian Institution, educational and research centers, and the National Zoo. NPR's Chloe Veltman says the order blames the Biden administration for seeking to revise what their successors consider historical truth.
In a public talk just last Sunday about the Smithsonian American Art Museum's achievements and upcoming plans, Acting Director Jane Carpenter Rock said this.
Given our location here in the nation's capital, with significant levels of federal funding, we are also mindful of the rapid changes swirling around us in the federal government. And we are right now still navigating the impact they will have on the Smithsonian.
Now there's a lot more navigating to be done. A show at the American Art Museum, The Shape of Power, Stories of Race and American Sculpture, is specifically called out in President Trump's latest executive order for promoting, quote, narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. Among other stipulations, the order seeks to prohibit the Smithsonian from receiving funding for programs and exhibitions that, quote, degrade shared American values and divide Americans based on race, and to restore monuments and statues that have been removed from public spaces in recent years in response to growing calls to address racial injustice and the legacy of slavery. This is the latest in a series of recent White House executive orders aimed at rolling back diversity efforts. The Smithsonian Institution closed its diversity office in January. NPR reached out to the Smithsonian, several board members, and members of the museum and academic communities for comment, but received no immediate responses. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Major League Baseball season is upon us, and the Chicago Cubs are looking for an edge after a few frustrating seasons, so they called on 81-year-old baseball vet Jerry Weinstein to help. Weinstein is the club's new special assistant to the general manager, and he spoke with NPR's Scott Simon. You can hear their conversation Saturday on Weekend Edition. Listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News. Thank you.
of the next Fresh Air. The new film, The Friend, starring Bill Murray and Naomi Watts, was adapted from a novel by Sigrid Nunez. It's about a woman writer who reluctantly inherits a 180-pound Great Dane after his owner, her friend and former mentor, dies by suicide. Like her, the dog is grieving. We'll hear my interview with Nunez about the book. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. How many albums are so good you wouldn't skip a single track? One of today's greatest ambassadors of jazz, Branford Marsalis, fell in love with an album Keith Jarrett made in 1974 with three Scandinavian sidemen. It was called Belonging. Branford Marsalis is taking that appreciation next level. His quartet just released a reinterpretation of every piece from that album.
What I figured out when I was 14 years old playing in a cover band is that it's amazing how much better your music can be if you spend your time listening to and stealing from people who are better at it than you are.
I had to chuckle when I read some of the notes that came with the album, where you mentioned how you got into Keith Jarrett's music. I had that same kind of eureka feeling that you had, because I remember a friend introduced me to Keith Jarrett, and I was like, wait, how come I don't know about this? Like, what's happening here? Yeah. So could you just tell that story, if you wouldn't mind, about how you got into Keith Jarrett?
Oh, yeah. He made a record called The Calm Concerts that I wasn't particularly fond of. And my pianist at the time and my dear friend Kenny Kirkland said, man, you need to check Keith out. At that time in my life, I embraced that stupid adage, first impressions or lasting impressions. And my mind was made up, and then he slipped the headphones on my head on a plane. And I started listening, and I'm like, who is this? Oh, it must be Keith Jarrett, because he's been selling it. Man, this is pretty good. And then when he reached to take the headphones back, I covered my hands over the headphones and didn't allow him to. He just started to laugh. He says, man, that's what you get for being stubborn. I told you. And I bought all of that stuff.
So tell me a bit about how you and the quartet went about it. You clearly didn't sit there and transcribe pieces from the album. Number one, this is jazz, so that's not going to happen. But the tracks...
Don't kid yourself. That happens all the time.
Does it? Okay, well, I stand corrected.
There's a cottage industry out there with literal solos being worked out and regurgitated and still called improvisation.
Oh,
but
dear.
I digress.
Oh, dear. Okay. But these are not note for note the originals. They are definitely... You and the quartet, you're doing your thing.
Yeah, well, we have a different sonic perspective than those guys would have had in 1974. I grew up in New Orleans and grew up singing songs and clanging pencils on a fence, singing two-way Pocky Way. The guys in his band are clearly great musicians, but I feel comfortable in saying that some Norwegian guys born in the 1940s, weren't in a Southern University-type marching band and didn't grow up listening to R&B with the regularity that we did. So we have all these sonic perspectives that we can bring to the music, so we don't have to spend much time trying to alter or change the original songs or the construction of the songs, because how we interpret those songs will be automatically different than the way that they would interpret them.
So let's listen to an example. I'm just going to play one of my favorites, the Keith Jarrett piece, The Wind Up. Fun piece. Let's play a little bit of the original. Okay, now let's play some of my new favorite. This is your version of The Wind Up. I feel the New Orleans.
Yeah.
Am I right?
And the drummer's from Philly. That's what's okay. Wild about it. But he spent 2 months in New Orleans working on a film. Because he said, oh, man, you're always bragging about your raggedy-ass city. Well, I'm going to go live down there for 2 months. And 2 weeks into it, he's like, this is the most amazing city in the world. I said, well, in America, for sure. I don't know about the world, but he loved it, and he learned a lot of stuff. And when we play certain songs, it does have that kind of New Orleans romp feel to it. Piano player Joey. Joey's from New Rochelle, New York, and lives in Durham, North Carolina. Eric Rivas is from Fresno, but he lives in Los Angeles. But he did live in New Orleans for 2 years. So all the little New Orleans cues, I mean, those two guys know him for sure. So like at towards the end of the song in the middle, we have this song called The Second Line, and the trumpet player plays this phrase. And everybody has to go, hey!
Yes.
And I played it, and they said it. It wasn't one of those things where I scripted and said, okay, guys, when I play this lick, you guys say, hey, it was instinctive. They just went there.
I love it. Had you ever had a chance to work with Keith Jarrett?
No, I've never even met Keith.
Oh, wow.
People say, oh, do you think that's strange? I said, well, I haven't met Thelonious Monk either. Or Charlie Parker or Beethoven. But I still listen to the music and I still study things. The songs are hard to play. I will say that. I'm glad I didn't try to do this 15 years ago. I think we would have failed, or it just wouldn't have been very good. We would have succeeded to a degree, but the songs have beautiful melodies and great emotional depth, and you have to be a mature musician to grasp the emotion in each song and tailor the sound of your instruments and of your group to reproduce the emotion that's required. But for us, I mean, we've been dealing with all these different styles and strains of music since this particular iteration of the band started in 2009. So we didn't have to talk it through. We just had to play it.
That is Branford Marsalis. His quartet just released a reinterpretation of Keith Jarrett's 1974 album, Belonging. Branford Marsalis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. It was a pleasure to talk with you again.
This is NPR News.
President Trump's cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has some scallop fishermen facing stricter regulations on their catching limits.
Some are welcoming the cuts, saying that the government has been their downfall. There's too many regulations, and I don't share that opinion.
We'll talk smaller scallop catches at the dock on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston.
The White House has yet to name a new nominee to serve as the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. President Trump on Thursday withdrew Representative Elise Stefanik's nomination, citing the GOP's narrow majority in the lower chamber. NPR's Elena Moore reports.
The problem, it turned out, wasn't Stefanik, but House Republicans and their razor-thin majority. You know, on most bills, the party can only afford to lose one or two votes. There was a chance Stefanik's departure would only make things harder, which, you know, Trump decided was too risky.
That's NPR's Elena Moore reporting. Congressional Democrats are sharply criticizing the Trump administration's plans to restructure the Department of Health and Human Services. Washington Senator Patty Murray says the cutbacks will only make Americans sicker.
The American people will not forget it was Trump and RFK Jr. who gutted essential services and put their lives at risk. Today may be a great day for snake oil. It may be a great day for measles, but it is an incredibly alarming day for America.
Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says the agency is a sprawling bureaucracy that needs to be trimmed. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 516 points. This is NPR. President Trump has signed an executive order directing the vice president to oversee the removal of, quote, divisive race-centered ideology at Smithsonian museums. The order also applies to educational and research centers and the National Zoo. The move aligns with the administration's broader efforts to reshape cultural and historical narratives within the U.S., including previous actions that have restored Confederate-named army bases and statues. Chinese President Xi Jinping met with leaders of top global corporations today in Beijing. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports it's the latest in a series of moves aimed at wooing foreign investors.
At Beijing's Great Hall of the People, Xi told the executives to protect the global economic order, including industrial supply chains, from geopolitics. In an apparent swipe at what China sees as U.S. efforts to stifle its economy, Xi quipped, "Blowing out other people's lights does not make you brighter." CEOs at the meeting included the heads of Mercedes-Benz, FedEx, and oil conglomerate Saudi Aramco. Foreign direct investment in China plunged by 27% last year, according to official statistics, as foreign firms diversified operations away from China. The meeting follows one with China's tech firm CEOs last month, intended to give them the confidence to invest more. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Zoe Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Howard University, the historically black school here, opens a center today dedicated to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution after the Civil War. It establishes that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are American citizens, entitled to equal protection and due process under the law. Sherilyn Eiffel will lead the center. She holds the Verdon E. Jordan Jr. Esquire Chair in Civil Rights at Howard's Law School and is the former president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. I started our conversation by asking her to describe the goal of the program.
We are, after all, at a law school and try to be supportive of litigation brought by others, but we will not be bringing litigation ourselves. But it is really more of a space for research, for scholarship, for curriculum development, and for convening people together across disciplines to talk about the values of the 14th Amendment and to think through how to infuse those values into the various institutions of American life and into our educational institutions most of all.
One of the reasons people who aren't lawyers might recognize the 14th Amendment is that it establishes birthright citizenship.
Yeah.
And one of the executive orders that President Trump signed on his first day in office was an attempt to nullify it. But is part of the purpose of the center to weigh in on this discussion in some way, since this has been surfaced in this new era?
Yeah, it's very important. And in fact, you know, the 14th Amendment touches the life of every single person in this country, and they don't realize it. And birthright citizenship is just one of those ways. Birthright citizenship was created to overturn the Dred Scott decision, in which the Supreme Court had said that black people, whether they were enslaved or free, could not be citizens of this country. And so obviously black people are incredibly affected by birthright citizenship as well. But if you think about the waves of immigrants that have come from across the world to the United States with the understanding and the knowledge that they could become naturalized citizens, that their children, if born the day after they arrived in this country, will be citizens of this country, it gives you a sense of the reach and touch of the 14th Amendment.
What is your hope for the work of the center and how it will touch people who are not going to go to Howard Law School?
There are people all over this country who will proudly and passionately tell you about their Second Amendment rights. But when was the last time you heard somebody, an ordinary American, tell you about their 14th Amendment rights, even though those are the rights that guarantee equality in this country, that ensure that the state cannot take things from you without providing you with some due process, and that guarantee birthright citizenship? And the point of the center is to create the kind of curriculum, both formal and informal, and the kind of narrative that Americans can get their hands around so that they will come to cloak their conception of these rights that we take for granted in constitutional terms.
Before we let you go, the other thing that the 14th Amendment stipulates is that no one who's engaged in insurrection can hold high office in the United States. And I do wonder whether any of your scholarly work will be addressing that point, that part of the amendment.
Well, indeed. And of course, the Supreme Court issued a decision last year. We did file an amicus brief in that case last year, Trump versus Anderson. There are other provisions of the 14th Amendment that I want to explore as part of the work of this center. It is the longest amendment to the Constitution. So the part you read at the very beginning is the part that all law students learn. But even most law students didn't learn about Section 3, the insurrection clause. And most law students don't learn about Section 2, which purports to reduce the representation of states that engage in voter suppression. And so it really is a sleeping giant. And part of the purpose of this center is to fully familiarize Americans with the richness of this important constitutional amendment. And that would include all of its provisions that I think are quite relevant for the challenges that we face today.
That's Sherilyn Eiffel. She's a professor at Howard University's Law School. Professor Eiffel, thank you so much for talking with us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
Democratic voters upset over President Trump's spending cuts are also angry at their own party for what they say is too weak of a response. KQED's Guy Marzorati takes us to a town hall in California.
Ayla Ozturk showed up to a community center in Bakersfield earlier this week to make her voice heard about the Trump administration's efforts to slash spending.
They're just looking totally in the wrong places.
She's upset about potential cuts in the future to healthcare programs like Medicaid.
All of these areas are just being like cut and have been like neglected, and it makes me very angry.
Oesterk is mad at her own party for not doing more in the face of these cuts proposed by congressional Republicans.
People just want to see the Democratic Party just, like, do something.
California Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna organized these town halls hundreds of miles south from his Bay Area home. This one in a key swing district held by Republican Rep. David Valadao. Khanna came here to rally voters in Valadao's Central Valley district, where two-thirds of residents are on Medicaid, the most of any seat in California.
We need that organizing today to save Medicaid and to save our democracy.
But many of the locals who came up to the open mic were Democrats, wanting to get their own house in order.
We need more direction, I feel, from the Democratic Party.
Our leaders have done some serious damage to the party.
So what are the Democrats doing?
When is the Democratic Party going to set aside its peacetime leaders and bring up some wartime leaders? Because that's what we need.
Speakers were especially unhappy about Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer's recent decision to avert a government shutdown by supporting a Republican spending bill. Khanna criticized Schumer and called for new leadership in the party, which won the approval of Bakersfield resident Mitch Carrillo.
They were mentioning the old guard in the Democratic Party, and they've done some really great things, but it's time to step aside and let's let this younger generation come in and see what they can do.
In Carrillo's mind, this moment calls for a different energy.
Because the Republicans aren't playing fair. They're not playing by the rule book. Whatever it takes to win, they'll do. And so the Democrats don't have an answer for that.
California Democratic strategist Orrin Evans says for now, the anger at town halls is focused more on the party's posture, not its platform.
No one is showing up at these things screaming that we need to be more to the left on any one particular policy. It's where's the backbone? Let's fight.
Shoykat Chakrabarty is the former chief of staff to Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. In an interview with KQED, he says this desire to fight should morph into challenges to Democratic incumbents.
I really think we need dozens, if not hundreds, of people to take over the party. Due to the Democratic Party, what Trump did to Republicans, but not around a cult of personality, you know? We need a whole movement to do it.
And he agrees that movement is not necessarily about moving policy to the left.
I think it's a movement of people who actually want to act, who want to fight, and who want to go bigger and bolder, and who want to actually solve health care and actually get all this stuff built.
Chakrabarty is hoping to be part of that movement. He's mounting a run for Congress next year in the San Francisco seat held by Nancy Pelosi. For NPR News, I'm Guy Marzorati.
This is NPR News.
President Trump wants to make Canada the 51st state. It's not the first time that Americans have had hungry eyes for our northern neighbor. Next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. A miniature dachshund named Valerie has stayed alive all alone for 16 months in a place called Kangaroo Island in Australia. Seems she got out of her playpen, ran into the bush. A few months later, a wiener dog wearing a pink collar matching her description was spotted on camera. People think she's had to toughen up by eating roadkill and dodging venomous snakes. Seriously, the script for this animated movie version of this story is writing itself. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. For decades, the World Trade Organization refereed global trade disputes until it was sidelined by the U.S. So, in the midst of a new trade war, Waylon Wong and Adrian Ma of The Indicator from Planet Money explain why Washington has turned its back on an organization it helped create.
After World War II, powerful countries like the U.S. and the United Kingdom got together to set up the new ground rules for the global economy.
These post-war arrangements culminated in the creation of the World Trade Organization in 1995. It's basically a big club of countries that agree to trade with each other using the same set of rules.
When governments get into disputes over these rules, they go to the WTO. And here's how that process works. First, the case gets heard by a panel of experts. They make a ruling.
And then the governments can appeal that decision to a different panel of experts. This group is known as the appellate body.
Jennifer Hillman is a professor at the Georgetown Law Center, and she served on the appellate body from 2007 to early 2012.
You basically have to be ready to drop everything the minute you are put onto an appeal, fly to Geneva, and then the work is quite intense.
Intense, like 70 to 80 hour weeks. The panel has around just a couple of months to make a decision. And this ruling, by the way, is final.
And if at the end of the day, the appellate body says there was a violation, then what it does is recommend that the country bring its measure into compliance. In other words, fix the problem.
Fixing the problem might mean reducing tariffs on specific products or lifting a ban on certain kinds of imports. And for a while, the system of settling disputes worked. Jennifer says countries would generally follow the WTO rulings, even the U.S.
And the U.S. did lose at the WTO. Like several years ago, the state of Washington had to end a preferential tax rate for aerospace manufacturing. This came out of a long-running dispute between the U.S. and the EU over subsidies to companies like Boeing and Airbus.
Quinn Slobodian is a professor of international history at Boston University. He points out that when it helped found the WTO, the U.S. signed onto a system where it wouldn't always get its way.
It was a moment where America, the world's most powerful country, saw it somehow in its own interest to cede part of their sovereignty to this international institution.
However, the U.S. would eventually grow unhappy with the WTO. Quinn says a big factor here is China, which joined the group in 2001 and became an economic powerhouse. And yeah, China was part of the same economic club, but it was also claiming exemptions from free trade rules on the basis of it being a developing country. Jennifer says these frustrations came to a head during the Obama administration. And so the U.S. blocked the reappointment of some members to the WTO appeals panel. Then, during the first Trump administration, the U.S. started blocking all new appointments to the appellate body. In late 2019, the group stopped functioning because it didn't have enough members.
This paralysis continued through the Biden administration, although it had been in talks on reforming the WTO appeals panel. That work didn't get done before Biden left office.
Where does this leave other countries? Well, historian Quinn Slobodian says governments have been busy making trade deals without the U.S. In fact, Quinn says he thinks the future of international cooperation looks more like this, a bunch of regional agreements.
Waylon Wong,
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Today we have a story of immigration and a family's journey across three continents as told by a 10-year-old. Ameya Desai is one of the fourth grade winners in NPR Student Podcast Challenge. NPR's Janet Ujung Lee brings us her story and her winning entry.
When Ameya Desai started elementary school, she would pester her dad every morning on their drive to class.
Daddy, you owe me a story. Yeah. Like, Daddy, you owe me a story. And then when I was like, what for? I'm like, because I'm your daughter. Yeah. You have to tell me a story.
So her dad, Nikhil Desai, came up with a series of stories with original characters. One of them followed an ancient warrior who's on a quest to find her real family. Over time, he made up sequels. Then prequels.
So what happens is when I drop her off to school, I'll say, to be continued. And I think the story is still going. We never really finished the story, right? I think it's still ongoing. Yeah.
Years and years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
The father-daughter duo sit next to each other at the dining table at their home in San Jose, California. They constantly exchange eye contact and loving giggles throughout dinner.
That's my daughter to a T. You know, she loves stories.
So it's no surprise that Ameya, at a very young age, wanted to tell some of her own.
Hi, I'm Ameya Desai, and you are listening to Far From Home, a story of forced migration.
In her award-winning podcast, Ameya interviews her grandfather, Kishore Desai, who was born in Uganda.
Sugarcane fields stretch for miles all around as far as the eyes can see.
Kishore's parents had migrated from India, and his father worked at a sugarcane factory outside of Uganda's capital, Kampala.
We used to play a lot of sports by the side of sugarcane fields. And anytime one was hungry or thirsty, we just broke a sugarcane and chewed on it for instant sugar rush.
But Kishore's life was completely turned around when he was in college. In the summer of 1972, Uganda's leader Idi Amin ordered the mass expulsion of Asians from the country.
Idi Amin gave the Indians 90 days to leave Uganda. My grandfather's life changed forever.
I was in shock and disbelief. My family, once intact, was dispersed all over the world. We were never a single family unit again.
Kishore was stateless for years while he finished his studies. He then migrated to the United States, where he had to start all over again.
My friends and I want to be that generation that keeps talking about the stories of displacement, like my grandfather's, that don't get told often enough. I think when we share the pain and suffering of our history, we can ensure it doesn't happen to others.
Back at the dining room table, Ameya and her dad call grandfather Kishore.
Hi, Nikhil.
Hey, Dad.
They ask how listening to the podcast made him feel.
Totally taken aback, you know.
Nikhil says he too learned new details about his father's life.
Were it not for you and for the thing that you went through and the sacrifice that you made, I would not be here. Your granddaughter would not be here.
Thank you, Dada.
Hi, Amaya. You're welcome.
Bye.
What is the next project? I hope it doesn't involve me now.
And a funny thing happened when Amaya was announced one of the winners of the podcast challenge. Other people came forward wanting to share their stories with her.
Are you ready, Miss Amaya?
When we visited Williams Elementary School, Amaya was presenting her fifth grade research project. The topic she chose, the internment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War.
I interviewed Miss Linda Horikawa, a child who lived in the internment camps.
Her neighbor told Amaya stories from 80 years ago that she'd mostly kept to herself. Stories of her family being forced to leave their home.
Miss Linda said, my father carried a crib in each arm for me and my sister. We never knew where we would be going and if we would even have a bed.
Amaya's turning her interview with Miss Horikawa into her next podcast episode.
I worry this part of history will disappear when this generation is gone. It's important that we learn about the people who have lived through the experiences of war, not necessarily at the battlefield, but here at home.
Like any good journalist, Amaya's looking at the world around her for more stories.
Because that just kind of lit up a spark in me. You should always listen to that spark, because that means you're doing the right thing.
Advice from award-winning journalist Amaya Desai. If a story makes you feel something, don't just sit there. Do something about it. Janet Ujangli, NPR News, San Jose, California.
Rick Hubbard has been chasing a musical dream for 20 years. That's how long he's been trying to put together the world's largest kazoo ensemble as certified by the Guinness Book of World Records. Hubbard will try again today during the Cherry Blossom Festival in Macon, Georgia. And as Grant Blankenship of Georgia Public Broadcasting reports, he is actively recruiting.
Ready? Here we go.
Rick Hubbard is in a room full of kids, third graders. With kazoos, he has no fear.
I am the king of kazoo. All right, everybody stop.
He got on this path in 1987. Hubbard was a musician in a beach resort town, guitar mostly. Someone told him to make his act appeal to kids. The kazoo did the trick.
I'm the only professional kazoo player to ever play at the Kennedy Center.
So, king of kazoo. And the record for the most people playing kazoo for 5 minutes straight is 5,190, set in London in 2011.
And ever since the record in London came, we were like, no, we have to get this record back.
It's called Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
All Hubbard needs is 5,200, just 10 more kazooists to set the record in Macon.
All right, we're not gonna do the whole thing. It's 45 minutes.
And so he's trying to get these kids, maybe their whole families, to come out and help.
This is your white whale.
This is. It's my Moby Dick.
And Rick Hubbard hopes.
For our grand finale.
His legacy.
We're going to play a marching song. So I want everybody to stand up.
Someday in the future, when they write my obituary, they'll be able to say, Rick Hubbard, comma, leader of the world's largest kazoo band, comma, passed away today. At least there'll be something.
As for his chances of breaking the London record,
it'll be my claim to fame if we can do it. If not,
wait, let me hear you guys play it all together now.
At least we tried.
Rick Hubbard hopes lots of people will try with him on Friday afternoon, and you don't even need to bring your own kazoo. Hubbard brought about 10,000. For NPR News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon, Georgia.
All right, kick it up a notch. Play it loud now.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.